from the house. It was awful to witness. A complete shock. "Bomb," said Mahoney in surprise and anger. He must have booby-trapped the door. By then, the four other agents were inside the house. They had gone in through the back and side doors. There were no more explosions, so the other doors hadn't been booby-trapped. Two HRT agents approached the wounded pair at the front of the house. They pulled away the agent who hadn't moved since the blast. Mahoney and I ran as fast as we could toward the house. He kept repeating, "Fuck," over and over. There were no gunshots coming from inside. I was suddenly afraid Farley wasn't even in the house. I prayed that Audrey Meek wasn't already dead in there. Everything was feeling so wrong to me. This wasn't how I would have done the raid. The FBI. I had always hated and distrusted these bastards, and now I was one of them. Then I heard, "Secure! Secure!" and, "We have a suspect. We've got him. It's Farley. There's a woman here, too." What woman? Mahoney and I barged in through the side door. I saw thick smoke everywhere. The house reeked of the explosive, but also of marijuana and greasy cooking. We made our way back to a bedroom off a small living room. A naked man and woman were spread-eagled on the bare wooden floor of the bedroom. The woman on the floor wasn't Audrey Meek. She was heavy, at least 40 or 50 pounds overweight. Rafe Farley looked to be close to 300 pounds, and had hideous clumps of red hair not only on his head, but all over his body. An old poster for the movie Cool Hand Luke was taped over a king-size bed that had no sheets or covers. Nothing else caught my eye. Farley was screaming at us, his face deep crimson. "I have rights! I have goddamn legal rights! You bastards are in real trouble!" I had a feeling that he might be right, and that if this screaming man had kidnapped Mrs. Meek, she was already dead. "You're the one in trouble, fat boy," an HRT agent barked in the suspect's face. "You too, girlfriend." Could this possibly be the couple who had taken Audrey Meek and Elizabeth Connolly? I didn't see how. So who in the hell were they? Chapter 39. Ned Mahoney and I were stuck in a close, dark pigsty of a bedroom with the suspect, Rafe Farley. The woman, who assured us she was his girlfriend, had put on a filthy bathrobe and been taken into the kitchen to be questioned. We were all angry about what had happened outside. Two agents had been wounded by a booby trap. Rafe Farley was the closest thing we had to a break in the case or a suspect. Things kept getting weirder. For starters, Farley spit at Mahoney and me until his mouth went dry. It was so strange and crazy that at one point, Ned and I just looked at each other and started to laugh.
"Think this is fucking funny?"
Farley rasped from the edge of the bed, where he was lodged like a beached whale. We'd made him put on clothes, blue jeans and a work shirt, mostly because we couldn't stand the sight of his flaccid rolls of fat and his tattoos of naked women and a purple dragon eating a child. "You're going down on kidnap and murder charges," Mahoney snarled at him. "You injured two of my men. One might lose an eye."
"You had no right coming in my house while I'm sleeping. I have enemies,"
Farley yelled and spit at Mahoney again.
"You barge in here 'cause I sell some weed, or I screw a married broad who likes me more than she likes her old man?"
"Are you talking about Audrey Meek?" I asked. All of a sudden, he went quiet. He stared at me, and his face and neck turned bright red. What was this? He wasn't a good actor, and he wasn't real smart either.
"What the hell are you talking about? You been smoking my shit?"
Farley said finally.
"Audrey Meek? That chick they kidnapped?"
Mahoney leaned forward.
"Audrey Meek. We know you know all about her, Farley. Where is she?"
Farley's piggy eyes seemed to be getting smaller.
"How the hell would I know where she is?"
Mahoney kept at him.
"You ever been in a chat room called Favorite Things 4?
Farley shook his head.
"Never heard of it."
"We have a record of your conversation, asshole," Ned said. "You got a lot of splaining to do, Lucy."
Farley looked confused.
"Who the hell is Lucy? What are you talking about, man? You mean like, I love Lucy?"
Mahoney was good at keeping Farley off guard. I thought we were working okay together.
You got her in the woods somewhere in Jersey, Mahoney yelled, then stamped his foot hard.
Did you hurt her? Is she all right?
Where is Audrey Meek? I picked up. Take us to her, Farley.
You're going back to prison. This time you don't get out again, I shouted in his face. It was as if Farley were finally waking up. He squinted his eyes and stared hard at us.
Lord, he smelled, especially now that he was scared.
Wait a fucking minute. Now I get it. That internet place? I was just showing off.
What's that supposed to mean?
Farley slumped down into himself as if we'd been beating him.
Favorite four is for freaks to talk. Everybody makes shit up, man.
But you didn't make up the stuff about Audrey Meek. You know things about her. You got it all right, I said.
The bitch turns me on. She's a fox. Hell, I collect catalogs for Meek, always have. All those skinny-ass models look like they need a good
You knew things about the abduction, Farley, I said.
I read the newspapers, watch CNN.
Who doesn't?
I told you, Audrey Meek turns me on. I wish I abducted her. You think I'd be sleeping with Cindy if Audrey Meek was around here?
I jabbed an index finger at Farley. You knew things that weren't in the newspapers.
He shook his huge head from side to side. Then he said,
Gotta scan her. Listen in on police radios and such. Shit, I didn't kidnap Audrey Meek. I wouldn't have the balls. I wouldn't. I'm all talk, man.
Mahoney cut in.
You had the balls to rape Carly Hope, he said.
Farley seemed to be shrinking inside himself again.
Nah. It's like I said in court. Carly was a girlfriend. I didn't rape her none. I don't have the balls. I didn't do nothing to Audrey Meek. I'm nobody. I'm nothing.
Rafe Farley stared at us for a long moment. His eyes were bloodshot. Everything about him was pathetic. I didn't want to, but I was starting to believe him. I'm nobody. I'm nothing. That was Rafe Farley, all right.
Chapter 40.
Sterling. Mr. Potter. The art director. Sphinx. Marvel. The Wolf. The cover names sounded harmless, but the men behind them weren't. During one session, Potter had nicknamed the group Monsters, Inc. as a joke, and that was an accurate description. They were monsters, all of them. They were freaks. They were deviants and worse. And then there was the Wolf, who was in a whole other class. They met on a secure website that was inaccessible to outsiders. All messages were encrypted and required a pair of keys. One key garbled the information. The second key was needed to recover it. More important, a hand scan was necessary to get onto the site. They were considering using a retinal scan or possibly an anal probe. The subject under discussion was the couple and what to do about them.
What the hell does that mean? What to do about them?
Asked the art director, who was jokingly called Mr. Softy because he could get very emotional, the only one of them who ever did.
It means just what it sounds like, answered Sterling. There's been a serious breach of security. Now we have to decide what to do about it. There's been sloppiness, stupidity, and maybe worse than that. They were seen. It puts us all in danger.
What are our options?
Art director continued.
I'm almost afraid to ask.
Sterling responded instantly.
Have you read the newspapers lately? Do you have a TV? A team of two took a woman in a mall in Atlanta, Georgia. They were spotted. A team of two abducted a woman in Pennsylvania, and they were seen. Our options? Do absolutely nothing, or do something extreme. An object lesson is needed for the other teams.
So, what are we doing about the problem?
Asked Marvel, who is usually spookily quiet but could be nasty when he was aroused.
For one thing, I've shut down all deliveries for the moment, said Sterling.
Nobody told me about that,
Sphinx erupted.
I'm expecting a delivery. As you all know, I paid a price for it. Why wasn't I informed before now?
No one said anything to Sphinx for several seconds. No one liked him. Besides, each of them was a sadist. They enjoyed torturing Sphinx or anyone else in the group who showed weakness.
I expect my delivery,
Sphinx insisted.
I deserve it, you bastards. Fuck you all.
Then he went offline in a huff. Typical Sphinx. Laughable, really. Except none of them was laughing right now.
The Sphinxster has left the building,
Potter finally said. Then Wolf took over.
I think that's enough idle chat for tonight. Enough fun and games. I'm concerned about the news stories. We need to deal with the couple in some decisive manner that satisfies me. What I propose is that we have another team pay them a visit. Is there any disagreement?
There was none, which wasn't unusual when the Wolf had the floor. All of them were petrified of the Russian.
There is some good news, though,
Potter said then.
This fuss and attention, it is exciting, isn't it? Gets the blood boiling. It's a hoot, right?
You're crazy, Potter. You're mad.
Don't you just love it?
The well-protected chat room was not protected enough. Suddenly, the Wolf said,
Don't say another word. Not a word. I think someone else is on with us. Wait. They're off now. Someone broke into the den, and now they're gone. Who could have gotten in here? Who let them in? Whoever it is, they're dead.
Chapter 41.
Lily Olson was 14 and a half years old, going on 24, and she honestly believed she'd heard everything until she hacked into the Wolf's den. The sick bastards in the well-protected but not protected enough chat room were all older men, and they were gross and despicable. They liked to talk incessantly about women's private parts and having vile sex with anyone and everything that moved. Any age, any gender, human or animal. The men were beyond disgusting. They made her want to puke. Only then it got a lot worse. And Lily wished she had never even heard of the Wolf's Den, never hacked into the highly protected chat room. They might be murderers. And then the leader, Wolf, actually discovered Lily was on the site with them, listening to everything they'd said. So now Lily knew about the murders and the kidnappings, everything they fantasized about and possibly did, only she didn't know if any of what she heard was real or not. Was it real? Or maybe they were making it all up. Maybe they were just nasty, sicko bullshitters. Lily almost didn't want to know the truth, and she didn't know what to do about the stuff she'd already overheard. She hacked onto their site, and that was illegal. If she went to the police, she'd be turning herself in, so she couldn't do that. Could she? Especially if the stuff on the site was just fantasies. So she sat in her room and pondered the unthinkable, then pondered it again. She felt so bad, so sick to her stomach, so sad, but she was also afraid. They knew she'd hacked into the Wolf's Den, but did they also know how to find her? If she were them, she'd know how. So were they already on their way to her house? Lily knew she should go to the police, maybe the FBI, but she couldn't bring herself to do it. She sat frozen. It was as if she were paralyzed. When the doorbell rang, she just about jumped out of her skin. Holy shit! Holy mother, it's them! Lily took a deep breath. Then she scurried downstairs to the front door. She looked through the peephole. She could hear her own heart thundering. Domino's Pizza. Jesus. She'd forgotten all about it. It was pizza delivery, not killers at the front door. And suddenly Lily was giggling to herself. She wasn't gonna die, after all. She opened the front door.
Chapter 42.
The Wolf had seldom been angrier, and someone had to pay. The Russian had a long-standing hatred for New York City and the smug and overrated metropolitan area. He found it filthy, foul beyond imagining, the people rude and uncivilized, even worse than in Moscow. But he had to be there today. It was where the couple lived, and he had business with them. The Wolf also wanted to play some chess, one of his passions.
Long Island was the general address he had for Slava and Zoya. Huntington was the specific one. He arrived in the town just past 3 p.m. He remembered the one other time he'd been here, 2 years after he had arrived in New York from Russia. Cousins of his owned a house here and had helped him set up in America. He had committed 4 murders out on the island, as the locals called it. Well, at least Huntington was close to Kennedy Airport. He'd be out of New York as soon as possible. The couple lived in a typical suburban ranch house. The wolf banged on the front door, and a goateed bull of a man by the name of Lukanov opened it. Lukanov was part of another team, one that worked successfully in California, Oregon, and Washington State. Lukanov had once been a major in the KGB. "Where are the stupid fucks?" the wolf asked, once he was inside the front door. The bull, Lukanov, jerked a thumb toward a semi-darkened hallway behind him, and Wolf trudged down it. His right knee was aching today, and he remembered a time in the 80s when members of a rival gang had broken it. In Moscow, that kind of thing was considered a warning. The Wolf wasn't much for warnings himself. He had found the 3 men who tried to cripple him and broken every bone in their bodies, one by one. In Russia, this gruesome practice was called zamoshit. But the Wolf and other gangsters also called it mushing. He entered a small, sloppily kept bedroom and immediately saw Slava and Zoya, his ex-wife's cousins. The pair had grown up about 30 miles from Moscow. They had been in the army until the summer of 98. Then they emigrated to America. They'd been working for him for less than 8 months, so he was just getting to know them.
"You live in a garbage dump," he said. "I know you have plenty of money. What do you do with it?"
"We have family at home," said Zoya. "Your relatives are there too."
The wolf tilted his head.
"Oh, so touching. I had no idea you had such a big heart of gold, Zoya."
He motioned for the bull to leave and said,
"Shut the door. I'll be out when I'm finished here. It might be a while."
The couple was tied up together on the floor. Both were in their underwear. Slava had on shorts patterned with little ducks. Zoya wore a black bra with a matching bikini thong. The wolf finally smiled.
"What am I going to do with you two, huh?"
Slava began to laugh out loud, a nervous, high-pitched cackling. He had thought they were going to be killed, but this could just be a warning. He could see this in the wolf's eyes.
"So, what happened? Tell me quickly. You knew the rules of the game," he said.
"Maybe it was getting too easy. We wanted a little more of a challenge. It's our mistake, Pasha. We got sloppy."
"Never lie to me," the wolf said. "I have my sources. They are everywhere."
He sat on the arm of an easy chair that looked as if it had been in this hideous bedroom for 100 years. Dust puffed from the old chair as it took his weight.
"You like him?" he asked Zoya. "My wife's cousin?"
"I love him," she said, and her brown eyes went soft. "Always, since we were 13 years old. Forever I loved him."
"Slava, Slava," the wolf said,
and walked over to the muscular man on the floor. He bent to give Slava a hug.
"You are my ex-wife's blood relative, and you betrayed me. You sold me out to my enemies, didn't you?" "Sure you did. How much did you get?"
"A lot, I hope." Then he twisted Slava's head as if he were opening a big jar of pickles. Slava's neck snapped, a sound that the wolf had come to love over the years, his trademark in the Red Mafia. Zoya's eyes widened to about twice their normal size, but she didn't make a sound. And because of that, the wolf understood what tough customers she and Slava really were, how dangerous they had been to the safety of the organization.
"I'm impressed, Zoya," he said. "Let's talk some."
He stared into those amazing eyes of hers.
"Listen, I'm going to get the two of us some real vodka, Russian vodka. Then I want to hear your war stories," he said. "I want to hear what you've done with your life, Zoya. You have me curious now. Most of all, I want to play chess, Zoya. Nobody in America knows how to play chess. One game, then you go to heaven with your beloved Slava. But first, vodka and chess. And, of course, I fuck you.
Chapter 43.
On account of secrets that Zoya had told him under significant duress, the wolf had to make one more stop in New York. Unfortunate. This meant that he wouldn't be able to catch his flight home out of Kennedy, and he would miss the professional hockey game that night. Regretful, but he knew this was the right thing to do. The betrayal by Slava and Zoya had jeopardized his life and also made him look bad. At a little past 11, he entered a club called The Passage in the Brighton Beach section of Brooklyn. The Passage looked like a dump from the street, but inside it was beautiful, very ornate, almost as nice as the best places in Moscow. He saw people he knew from the old days, Gosha Chernov, Lev Denisov, Yurifomin and his mistress. Then he spotted his darling Yulia. His ex-wife was tall and slender, with large breasts he'd bought for her in Palm Beach, Florida. Yulia was still beautiful in the right light, not so much changed since Moscow, where she had been a dancer since she was 15. She was sitting at the bar with Mikhail Biryukov, the latest king of Brighton Beach. They were directly in front of a mural of St. Petersburg, which was very cinematic, thought the wolf, a typical Hollywood visual cliché. Yulia saw him coming, and she tapped Biryukov. The local pecan turned to look, and the wolf closed in on him fast. He slammed a black king down on the table. "Checkmate," he roared, then laughed and hugged Yulia. "You're not happy to see me," he asked them. "I should be hurt." Biryukov grunted. "You are a mystery man. I thought you were in California." "Wrong again," said the wolf. "By the way, Slava and Zoya say hello. I just saw them out on Long Island. They couldn't make the trip here tonight." Yulia shrugged. "Such a cool little bitch."
"They mean nothing to me," she said. "Distant cousins."
"Or me either, Yulia. Only the police care about them now."
Suddenly he grabbed Yulia by the hair and lifted her out of the bar seat with one arm. "You told them to fuck me over, didn't you? You must have paid them a lot," he screamed in her face. "It was you and him." With dazzling speed, the wolf pulled an ice pick from his sleeve and stuck it into Biryukov's left eye. The gangster was blinded and dead in an instant.
"No, please."
Yulia struggled to get out a few words.
"You can't do this, not even you."
Then the wolf addressed everyone in the nightclub.
"You are all witnesses, are you not? What, nobody helps, sir? You're afraid of me? Good, you should be. Yulia tried to get revenge on me. She was always stupid as a cow. Biryukov, he was just a dumb, greedy bastard. Ambitious. The godfather of Brighton Beach. What is that? He wanted to be me."
The wolf lifted Yulia even higher in the air. Her long legs kicked violently, and one of her red mules went flying, scooting under a nearby table. Nobody picked up the shoe. Not a person in the club moved to help her, or to see if Mikhail Biryukov was still alive. Word had already circulated that the madman in the front of the passage was the wolf.
"You are witnesses to what happens. If anyone ever crosses me, you are witnesses. So you've had a warning, same as in Russia, same now in America."
The wolf took his left hand out of Yulia's hair and wrapped it around her throat. He twisted hard, and Yulia's neck broke.
"You are witnesses," he screamed in Russian. "I killed my ex-wife, and this rat, Biryukov. You saw me do it, so go to hell."
And then the wolf stomped out of the nightclub. No one did a thing to stop him. And no one talked to the New York police when they came. Same as in Russia, same now in America.
Chapter 44.
Benjamin Coffey was being held in a dark root cellar under the barn where he'd been brought. What was it now? 3, maybe 4 days ago? Benjamin couldn't remember exactly, couldn't keep track of the days. The Providence College student had nearly lost his mind.
until he made an amazing discovery in the solitary confinement of the cellar. He found God, or maybe God found him. The first and most startling thing Benjamin felt was God's presence. God accepted him, and maybe it was time for him to accept God. He learned that God understood him. But why couldn't he understand the first thing about God? It didn't make sense to Benjamin, who'd attended Catholic schools from kindergarten up to his senior year at Providence, where he studied philosophy and also art history. Benjamin had come to another conclusion in the darkness of his prison cell under the barn. He'd always thought that he was basically a good person, but now he knew that he wasn't, and it didn't have anything to do with his sexuality, as his hypocritical church would have him think. The way he figured it, a bad person was someone who habitually caused harm to others. Benjamin was guilty of that by his treatment of his parents and siblings, his classmates, his lovers, even his so-called best friends. He was mean-spirited, always acted superior, and continually inflicted unnecessary pain. He had acted like this ever since he could remember. He was cruel, a snob, a martinet, a sadist, a complete piece of shit. He'd always justified his bad behavior because other people had caused him so much pain. So was that why things had turned out like this? Maybe. But what was truly astonishing to Benjamin was the realization that if he ever got out of this alive, he probably wouldn't change. In fact, he believed he would use this experience as an excuse to continue being a miserable bastard for the rest of his life. Cold. Cold. I'm so cold, he thought. But God loves me unconditionally. That never changes either. Then Benjamin realized that he was incredibly confused and crying, and had been for a long time, at least a day. He was shivering, babbling nonsense to himself, and he didn't know what he really thought about anything. Not anymore, he didn't. His mind kept shifting back and forth. He did have good friends, great friends, and he'd been an okay son. So why were all these terrible thoughts shuttling through his head? Because he was in hell? Was that it? Hell was this foul-smelling, claustrophobic root cellar under a decaying barn somewhere in New England, probably New Hampshire or Vermont. Was that right? Maybe he was supposed to repent and couldn't be set free until he did. Or maybe this was it. For eternity. He remembered something from Catholic grade school in Great Barrington, Rhode Island. A parish priest had tried to explain an eternity in hell to Benjamin's sixth grade class. Picture a river with a mountain on the other side, the priest had said. Now imagine that every 1,000 years, the tiniest sparrow transports what it can carry in its beak across the river from the mountain. When that tiny sparrow has transported the entire mountain to this side of the river, that, boys and girls, would just be the beginning of eternity. But Benjamin didn't really believe the priest's little fable, did he? Fire and brimstone forever? Somebody would find him soon. Somebody would guide him out. Unfortunately, he didn't completely believe that either. How could anyone find him here? They wouldn't. God, the police had lucked out finding the Washington sniper, and Malvo and Muhammad weren't very smart. Mr. Potter was. He had to stop crying soon because Potter was angry with him already. He'd threatened to kill him if he didn't stop, and oh, God, that was why he was crying so hard now. He didn't want to die, not when he was just 21 and had his whole life ahead of him. An hour later, 2 hours, three, he heard a loud noise above him and began to cry again. Now Benjamin couldn't stop sobbing, shaking all over. He was sniveling, too. He'd sniffed and sniveled since preschool. Stop sniveling, Benjamin. Stop it. Stop it. But he couldn't stop. Then the trap door opened. Someone was coming down. Stop the crying. Stop the crying. Stop it. Stop it this instant. Potter will kill you. Then the most unbelievable thing happened. A turn of events that Benjamin would never have expected. He heard a deep voice, not Potter's. Benjamin Coffey? Benjamin? This is the FBI.
Mr. Coffey, are you down there? This is the FBI.
He was shaking worse now and sobbing so hard he thought he might choke behind the gag. Because of the gag, he couldn't call out, couldn't let the FBI somehow know that he was down here. The FBI found me. It's a miracle. I have to signal them, but how? Don't leave. I'm down here. I'm right here. A flashlight illuminated his face. He could see a person behind the light, a silhouette. Then the full face peered out of the shadows. Mr. Potter was frowning down at him from the trap door. Then he stuck out his tongue.
I told you what was going to happen. Didn't I tell you, Benjamin? You did this to yourself. And you're so beautiful. God, you're perfect in every other way.
His tormentor came down the stairs. He saw a battered sledgehammer in Potter's hand. A heavy farm tool. Waves of fear washed over Benjamin.
I'm a lot stronger than I look, Potter said. And you've been a very bad boy.
Chapter 45.
Mr. Potter's real name was Homer O. Taylor, and he was an assistant professor in the English department at Dartmouth. Brilliant, to be sure, but still an assistant, a nobody. His office was a small but cozy one in the turret at the northwest corner of the Liberal Arts Building. He called it his garret, the place where a nobody would labor in lonely solitude. He had been up there most of the afternoon with the door locked, and he was fidgeting. He was also grieving for his beautiful dead boy, his latest tragic love, his third. Part of Homer Taylor wanted to hurry back to the barn at the farm in Webster to be with Benjamin, just to watch over the body for a few more hours. His Toyota 4Runner was parked outside, and he could be there in an hour if he pushed it.
Benjamin, dear boy, why couldn't you have been good? Why did you bring out the worst in me when there was so much to love? Benjamin had been such a beauty, and the loss that Taylor felt now was horrifying. And not only the physical and emotional drain, there was the great financial loss. 5 years ago, he'd inherited a little over $2 million. It was going too fast, much too fast. He couldn't afford to play like this, but how could he ever stop now? He wanted another boy already. He needed to be loved, and to love someone. Another Benjamin, only not an emotional wreck as the poor boy had been. So he stayed in his office for the entire day to avoid an excruciating hour-long tutorial at 4 o'clock. He pretended to be marking term papers in case someone knocked, but he never looked at a single page. Instead, he obsessed. He finally contacted Sterling around 7 o'clock.
I want to make another purchase, he said.
Chapter 46.
I visited Samson and Billy one night and had a great time with them, talking about babies and scaring big bad John Samson as much as I could. I tried to talk to Jamila at least once a day, but White Girl was starting to heat up, and I knew what that meant. I was probably about to get lost in the case. A married couple, Slav Vasilyev and Zoya Petrov, had been found murdered in the house they rented on Long Island. We had learned that the husband and wife had come to the United States 4 years before. They were suspected of bringing Russian and other Eastern European women here for the purpose of prostitution, and also to bear children who would be sold to affluent couples. Agents from our New York office were all over the murder scene on Long Island. Photographs of the two victims had been shown to the high school students who had seen the Connolly abduction and to Audrey Meek's children. They had identified the couple as the kidnappers. I wondered why the bodies had been left there. As examples? For whom? Monty Donnelly and I regularly met at 7 before I had to attend orientation classes for the day. We were analyzing the Long Island murders. Monty pulled together everything she could find on the husband and wife, as well as other Russian criminals working in the U.S., the so-called Red Mafia. She was hot-wired into the organized crime section over at the Hoover Building, and also the Red Mafia squad in the Bureau's New York office. I brought everything bagels from D.C., I said, as I entered her cube at 7:10 Monday. Best in the city. According to Zagat, anyway. You don't seem too excited. You're late, Mani said, without looking up from her computer screen. She'd mastered the droll deadpan delivery style favored by hackers. These bagels are worth it, I said. Trust me. I don't trust anybody, Mani replied. She finally glanced up at me and smiled. Nice smile. Worth the wait. You know that I'm kidding, right? It's just a tough girl act, Alex. Give her the bagels. I laughed. I'm used to cop humor. Oh, I'm honored, she muttered, deadpan again, as she looked back at the glowing computer screen. He thinks I'm a cop, not just a desk jockey. You know, they started me in fingerprinting. The absolute bottom. I liked Mani, but I had the sense that she needed a lot of support. I knew she'd been divorced for about 2 years. She'd majored in criminology at Maryland for undergrad, where she had also pursued another interesting passion, studio arts. Mani still took classes in drawing and painting, and of course there was the mural in her cube. She yawned. Sorry. I watched Alias with the boys last night. That will be Grandma's problem when she has to get them up this morning. Mani's home life was another thing we had in common. She was a single parent with 2 young kids and a doting grandmother who lived less than a block away. The grandmother was her ex-husband's mother, which told the story of the marriage. Jack Donnelly had played basketball at Maryland, where he and Mani met. He was a big drinker in college, and it got worse once he graduated. Mani said he'd never recovered from being all everything in high school and then just another guard for the Maryland Terrapins. Mani was 5 foot even and joked that she hadn't played any kind of ball at Maryland. She told me her nickname in high school was Spaz. I've been reading all about women being traded and sold from Tokyo to Riyadh, she said. Breaks my heart and it pisses me off. Alex, we're talking some of the worst slavery in history. What's with you men? I looked at her. I don't buy and sell women, Mani. Neither do any of my friends. Sorry. I'm carrying around a little extra baggage because of Jack the Rat and a few other husbands I know. She looked at her computer screen. Here's a choice quote for today. Know what the Thai premier said about the thousands of women from his country sold into prostitution? Thai girls are just so pretty. And here's the premier on 10-year-old girls being sold. Come on. Don't you like young girls, too? I swear to God he said that. I sat down next to Mani and peered at her computer screen. So now somebody's opened a lucrative market for suburban white women. Who? And where are they working out of? Europe? Asia? The U.S.? The murdered couple could be a break for us. Russians. What do you think? She asked. Could be a ring operating out of New York, Brighton Beach, or maybe they're headquartered in Europe. The Russian mob is set up just about everywhere these days. It's not the Russians are coming anymore. They're here. Mani started to spit out information. The Soltsova gang is the largest crime syndicate in the world right now. Did you know that? They're big here, too. Both coasts. The Red Mafia has basically collapsed in their country. They smuggled close to $100 billion out of Russia, and a lot of it came here. You know, we've got major task forces working in L.A., San Francisco, Chicago, New York, D.C., Miami. The Reds bought banks in the Caribbean and Cyprus. Believe it or not, they've taken over prostitution, gambling, and money laundering in Israel. In Israel! I finally got a few words in. I spent a couple of hours last night reading the files from Anti-Slavery International. The Red Mafia comes up there, too. I'll tell you one other thing. She looked at me. That kid who was grabbed in Newport. I know it's a different pattern. I get it. But I do believe he's part of this. What do you think? I nodded. So did I. And I also thought that Mani had great street smarts for somebody who rarely left the office. So far, she was the best person I'd met at the Bureau. And here we were in her tiny cube, trying to solve White Girl.
Chapter 47
I had never really stopped being a student since my days at Johns Hopkins, and it had served me well in the Washington PD, even given me a certain mystique. I hoped it would be the same in the Bureau, though it hadn't been so far. I set myself up with a supply of black coffee and started in on the Russian mob research. I needed to know everything about them, and Monty Donnelly was a willing accomplice. I made notes along the way, though I usually remember most of what is important enough and don't need to write it down. According to the FBI files, the Russian mob was now more diverse and powerful in America than La Cosa Nostra. Unlike the Italian mafia, the Russians were organized into loose networks that cooperated with but weren't dependent on one another. At least not so far. A major benefit was that the loose style of organization avoided RICO prosecutions by the government. No conspiracies could be proved. There were two distinctly different types of Russian mobsters. The knuckle-draggers were into extortion, prostitution, and racketeering, and their particular crime group was called the Solntsevo. The second type of Russian mobster operated at a more sophisticated level, often securities fraud and money laundering. These were the neo-capitalist criminals, called the Izmailova. For the moment, I decided to concentrate on the first group, the lowlifes, especially the brigades involved with prostitution. According to the Bureau's OC section report, the prostitute business operated a lot like Major League Baseball. A group of prostitutes could actually be traded from an owner in one city to one in another. As a footnote, a survey conducted among seventh-grade girls in Russia listed prostitution among the top five career choices of the girls when they grew up. Several historical anecdotes had been inserted in the file to represent the Russian criminal mentality. Smart and ruthless. According to one story, Ivan the Terrible had commissioned St. Basil's Cathedral to rival, even surpass, the great churches of Europe. He was pleased with the result and invited the architect to the Kremlin. When the artist arrived, his blueprints were burned and his eyes poked out, thus ensuring that he could never create a finer cathedral for anyone else. There were several more contemporary examples in the report, but that was how the Red Mafia worked. It was what we were up against if the Russians were behind White Girl.
Chapter 48.
Something incredible was about to happen. It was a gorgeous afternoon in eastern Pennsylvania. The art director found himself lost in the dazzling blue of the sky, and the reflections of the white clouds sliding across his windshield were mesmerizing. "Am I doing the right thing now?" he had asked himself several times during the ride. He thought that he was. "You have to admit that it's beautiful," he said to the bound passenger in his Mercedes G-Class SUV. "It is," said Audrey Meek. She was thinking that she believed she would never see the outdoors again, never smell fresh grass and flowers. So where was this madman taking her with her hands tied? They were driving away from his cabin. Going where? What did it mean? She was terrified, but trying not to show it. "Small talk," she told herself. "Keep him talking." "You like this G-Class?" she asked, and immediately knew it was an insane question. Just insane. His tight smile, but especially his eyes, told her that he thought so too, and yet he answered politely. "I do, actually. At first I thought it was the final proof that rich people are incredibly stupid. I mean, it's kind of like putting a Mercedes logo on a wheelbarrow and then paying triple for it. But I do like the oddness of the vehicle, the rigid lines of the design, the gizmos like lockable differentials. Of course, I'll have to get rid of this one now, won't I?" Oh, God. She was afraid to ask why, but maybe she knew already. She'd seen the car he drove. Maybe someone else had, too. But she'd also seen his face, so he wasn't really making sense. Or was he? Suddenly, Audrey found that she couldn't talk at all. No words would come out of her mouth, which was very dry. This self-professed nice guy who said he wanted to be her friend, but who had raped her half a dozen times, was going to kill her very soon. And then what? Bury her out here in the beautiful woods? Dump her body in a gorgeous lake with a heavy weight attached to it? Tears formed in Audrey's eyes, and her brain buzzed as if there were a short in the circuits. She didn't want to die. Not now.
not like this. She loved her children, her husband, George, and even her company. It had taken her so long, so much sacrifice and hard work to get her life right, and now this had to happen, this fluke, this incredibly bad luck. The art director turned sharply onto a narrow dirt road, then sped down it much too fast. Where was he going? Why so fast? What was at the end of the road? But apparently they weren't going all the way to the end. He was braking. My God! No! Audrey screamed. No! Please! Don't! He stopped the car, but let the engine run. Please! She pleaded. Oh, please! Don't do this! Please, please, please! You don't have to kill me! The art director merely smiled. Give us a hug, Audrey. Then get out of the car before I change my mind. You're free. I'm not going to hurt you. You see, I love you too much.
Chapter 49.
There was a break in White Girl. One of the women had been found. Alive. I was rushed to Bucks County, Pennsylvania, in one of the two Bell helicopters kept at Quantico for emergencies. A few senior agents had told me that they'd never been up in one of the helicopters. It didn't sit too well with them. Now here I was becoming a regular during my orientation period. There were benefits to being on the director's fast track. The sleek black Bell sat down in a small field in Norristown, Pennsylvania. During the flight, I found myself thinking of a recent orientation class. We'd burned fingernail clippings so that everybody would know what a DOA smelled like. I already knew, and I didn't relish experiencing it again. I didn't think there would be any DOAs on this trip to Pennsylvania. Unfortunately, that turned out to be wrong. Agents from the field office in Philadelphia were there to meet the helicopter and accompany me to where Audrey Meek had been brought for questioning. So far, there'd been no announcement to the press, though her husband had been notified and was on his way to Norristown. I'm not exactly sure where we are right now, I said as we rode to a local state trooper's barracks. How far is this from where Mrs. Meek was abducted? We're 5 miles, said one of the agents from Philly. It would take about 10 minutes by car. Was she held captive near this area, I asked. Do we know yet? What exactly do we know? She told the state police that the abductor brought her here early this morning. She's not sure of the directions, but thinks they rode for well over an hour. Her wristwatch has been taken away from her. I nodded. Was she blindfolded during the ride? I assumed that she was. No, that's odd, isn't it? She saw her captor several times, also his vehicle. He didn't seem to care one way or the other. That was a genuine surprise to me. It didn't track, and I said so. Stump the stars, said the agent. Isn't that what this case is about so far? The state trooper barracks occupied a red brick building tucked back from the highway. There wasn't any activity outside, and I took that as a good sign. At least I had beaten the press there. No one had leaked the story so far. I hurried inside the barracks to meet Audrey Meek. I was eager to find out how she had survived against all odds. The first woman who had.
Chapter 50.
My very first impression was that Audrey Meek didn't look at all like herself. Not as she did in any of her publicity. Not now, anyway. Not after her terrible ordeal. Mrs. Meek was thinner, especially in the face. Her eyes were dark blue, but the sockets appeared hollowed out. She had some color on both cheeks. I'm FBI Agent Alex Cross. It's good to see you safe, I said, in a quiet voice. I didn't want to interview her right now, but it had to be done. Audrey Meek nodded, and her eyes met mine. I had the sense that she knew how lucky she was. You have some color in your cheeks. Did you get that today? I asked her. While you were in the woods?
I don't know for sure, but I don't think so. He took me outside for walks every day he held me captive. Considering the circumstances, he was often considerate. He made my meals, good ones for the most part. He told me he'd been a chef at one time in Richmond. We had long talks almost every day, really long talks. It was so strange, everything about it. There was one day in the middle when he wasn't at the house at all. I was petrified he'd left me there to die. But I didn't really believe he would.
I didn't interrupt her. I wanted to let Audrey Meek tell her story without any pressure or steering from me. It was astonishing to me that she had been released. It didn't happen very often in cases like this one.
George? My children?
She asked.
Have they arrived yet? Will you let me see them if they're here?
They're on their way, I said. We'll bring them in as soon as they arrive. I'd like to ask a few questions while everything is still fresh in your mind. I'm sorry about this. There may be other missing people, Mrs. Meek. We think that there are.
Oh, God, she whispered. Let me try to help, then. If I can, I will. Ask your questions.
She was a brave woman, and she told me about the kidnapping, including a description of the man and woman who had grabbed her. It fit the late Slav Vasilyev and Zoya Petrov. Then Audrey Meek took me through the ritual of the days that she was held captive by the man who called himself the art director.
He said he liked to wait on me, that he enjoyed it immensely. It was as if he was used to being subservient, but I sensed he also wanted to be my friend. It was so terribly weird. He'd seen me on TV and read articles about Meek, my company. He said he admired my sense of style and the way I didn't seem to have too many airs about myself. He made me have sex with him.
Audrey Meek was holding herself together so well. Her strength amazed me, and I wondered if that was what her captor had admired. Can I get you water? Anything? I asked. She shook her head.
I saw his face, she said. I even tried to draw it for the police. I think it's a good likeness. It's him.
This was getting stranger by the moment. Why would the art director let her see him, then release her? I'd never known anything like it, not in any other kidnapping case. Audrey Meek sighed and nervously clasped and unclasped her hands as she continued.
He admitted that he was obsessive-compulsive, about cleanliness, art, style, about loving another human being. He confessed several times that he adored me. He was often derogatory about himself. Did I tell you about the house?
She asked.
I'm not sure what I said here, or to the officers who found me.
You didn't talk about the house yet, I said.
It was covered with some material, like a heavy-duty cellophane. It reminded me of event art, like Christo. There were dozens of paintings inside, very good ones. You ought to be able to find a house covered in cellophane.
We'll find it, I agreed. We're looking now. The door to the room where we were talking was cracked open. A trooper in a brimmed hat peeked in. Then he opened the door wide, and Audrey Meek's husband, George, and her two children burst inside. It was such an unbelievably rare moment in abduction cases, especially one in which someone has been missing for more than a week. The Meek children looked afraid at first. Their father gently urged them forward, and joy took over. Their faces were wreathed in smiles and tears, and there was a group hug that seemed to last forever.
"Mommy, Mommy, Mommy!"
the girl shrieked, and clung to her mother as if she'd never let go of her again. My eyes filled, and then I went to the work table. Audrey Meek had made two drawings. I looked at the face of the man who had held her captive. He looked very ordinary, like anybody you'd meet on the street. The art director.
Why did you let her go?
I wondered.
Chapter 15.